you think life is simpler as time evolves? For some, it can be more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. We're going to pick up this week with where we left off last week. So with us this week is Teresa Yao, a popular guest on the show. She's an attorney with Tucker Allen. Of course, many of you know Tucker Allen does exclusively estate planning, elder law. So we recognize from the clients of Tucker Allen and from having done this show now for how many years has it been?
Long time.
Jill, it's been at least 6 years, I guess.
My goodness.
Boy, time flies. So those of you, though, who are in this situation, you get what I'm talking about. It's kind of the elephant in the room. You have 401k dollars saved that you expect to live on, that you don't need. You're going to pass along, and hopefully you have good estate planning to minimize taxation.
Very important.
Yes, you can pass along those tax advantaged assets to your loved ones, and they can enjoy tax advantages as well through proper planning. But let's go back then to this question about how would you pay for it if you were going to spend some period of time in long-term care? We know that many of you don't have insurance. Matter of fact, long-term care insurance is becoming less and less common across the country. Last I checked, there were two national firms left offering this product.
Two.
And that's because it has sunk and threatens to sink these other companies, but has sunk companies who have had on their books these contingent liabilities that they knew were going to dwarf their ability to pay these claims. And that wasn't so much fraud or deception. It was largely the fact that no one could foresee the cost of this long-term care. You know, we have additional technology. We have additional pharmacology. We just have ways in which we can extend lifespan far beyond what we thought, but it certainly isn't cheap. So we decided to dedicate these two shows to the avenue that will be appropriate for many of you, not all of you, but many of you, and we want to introduce you to this topic. And we recognized at the outset, whenever you talk about Medicaid to somebody who, you know, has worked their whole lives, who haven't, for the most part, applied for government programs, I'm willing to bet that that's many of our listeners, they're uncomfortable with the idea of turning to something such as Medicaid for help here. And we took that on last week, but I want to bring it up again because I know that it kind of lurks below the surface in many people's minds.
Yes, and so many people think that they don't qualify because of their income level, even, you know, say the affluent. And that's why we're so glad to have our expert back with us, Teresa Yao, an attorney with Tucker Allen, to help us, you know, talk through all of these, you know, this very complicated system, I guess you might say.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, and Teresa and I were walking through this last week, and we're going to struggle to get through as much as we can in two shows, and certainly we can circle back, as we have. We've brought this subject up over the years. But as you, Jill, just pointed out, people need to pay attention to what these criteria are and not simply dismissively say, oh, that's Medicaid, I don't qualify for that sort of thing.
Right.
But the reality is the rules of Medicaid have been written specifically for people in certain circumstances, and they've also provided certain exceptions and certain contingencies, things where with proper planning, there's a good chance that you will qualify. Again, we don't know that. It depends on your particular circumstances. So we want to introduce you to this topic, and we'll try not to get too far into the weeds. And if you didn't listen to the show last week, go to our website and pull up last week's show.
Very good point to review. And so, Teresa, what are the methods of protecting your assets if you do want to qualify for Medicaid for long-term care?
Yeah, so I like to think of it in two main categories. So ideally, you're thinking about this, it's on your radar ahead of time, and you give yourself that five-year time period, which is that look-back period from Medicaid's perspective. So that would be the pre-planning category and then also the crisis planning. And then depending on which situation you're in, different instruments might be more applicable for you.
So let me clarify that. So if you've done your planning and you can say, say today, for example, that you foresee that you'll probably be healthy for 5 years or close to 5 years, that's the look-back period. That's the period that if you make transfers of assets to a trust, for example, that the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services will look back to determine whether or not you will get penalized. Now, a transfer penalty is not a penalty like you've done wrong. It's an adjustment, in fact. So it's more like a transfer adjustment. But it does mean that there's a period of time before you'll be eligible for those benefits that you would otherwise get, such as the cost of long-term care payments each month in a long-term care facility. So that number of months will hinge upon how much you transferred within this five-year window. So the point that Teresa's making is that if you're in a position where you're not at the threshold of having to enter long-term care, you've not recently seen a doctor who has perhaps made a diagnosis and you know this is imminent. So if you're in that first category, then it's very easy to plan and to make transfers and assets that will make you eligible, presumably, for Medicaid. And then when Teresa uses the phrase crisis planning, that's simply another way of saying the people in that second category, the people who something's happened, something's been called to their attention, often
and they
a diagnosis.
Need Medicaid right now.
Yeah, and they need it now. It could have been a stroke. Lots of things can happen where you're suddenly at the threshold where you don't get to do the long-term planning. And there are solutions for you, but there are different tools. And quite frankly, they're a little more difficult, quite frankly, than to be able to do it otherwise.
You don't want to be in that situation. So that's why pre-planning 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, whatever the case may be,
right. Ideally, with pre-planning, you can protect all of your assets, right? You can put everything into this irrevocable trust, which we can talk more in detail about. And you can protect a lot more assets if you do pre-planning than if you go wait and wait and then wait until that crisis period where you need Medicaid eligibility on the spot.
Yeah. But here's the good news, though. The good news is that even if you are in that crisis scenario, there are things that can be done to save a substantial part of your assets. Here's the conversation you would have with an eligibility specialist, for example, from the Division of Social Services. The Family Services Division is charged with administering this program in the state of Missouri, which is called Health Net. And they will ask you a few simple questions. And essentially what they will say is, do you have any assets above, I'm simplifying this conversation, any assets above $4,000? Or is it $5,000
now? $5,000.
$5,000 now. And so you'll say, well, yeah, I've got savings. I've got this. I've got my 401k, these various things. I'm not rich, but yeah, I probably have $455,000 or so. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Smith, here's what we need you to do. Go ahead and start paying your long-term care costs, which we'll assume are $10,000 a month. If not now, soon, it will be running that. So, and then in, 45 months, mm-hmm. come back, and after you're down to $5,000, guess what? We're willing to pick up and start paying that additional cost. That is the conversation, simplified, that you face in the absence of any planning. Now, the good news is it doesn't have to be like that. You can actually protect that $450,000 probably, certainly if there's long-term planning. But even in the absence of long-term planning, in that situation that Teresa was just talking about where there's a crisis, you can probably, you know, again, you need to talk to a lawyer, look at your facts and your circumstances, but it's very likely that you can save all or a substantial part of the $450,000. Even with crisis planning, you can save a substantial part.
Right. There are several tools that can work with you, even if you come in for a crisis planning, because we know it's hard to gauge that timeline, right? So we do have people come in who they need Medicaid eligibility and they can't wait 5 years. And so there's different tools like Medicaid compliant annuities or smart spending. You may have heard of spend down. That's certain ways where you can use assets in ways that are most beneficial to you, or we can set up caregiver agreements. These are just some examples of the tools that are available, even if you come in with crisis.
Now, how does a caregiver agreement work?
So a caregiver agreement, there are certain criteria that has to be included in a caregiver agreement. And so how it works is if you have an adult child or a loved one that takes care of you and expends a decent chunk of time, you can set up an hourly rate at which they would be paid for the services that they're rendering to take care of you. But it's for a family. It's for a loved one normally. And then so based on the hourly rate, and also there's a caregiver log where the caregiver logs all the activities that they're doing for you, like grooming, bathing, activities of daily living type of work. So based on the log of how many hours that they're expending towards taking care of you and based on the hourly rate, that's a certain amount that can be passed down to your kids or whoever is taking care of you, that would be a legitimate transfer of assets that would not incur that penalty with Medicaid if you were to need it later on.
So you, yourself, you're mm-hmm. paying that child or relative, whoever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not considered an uncompensated transfer because, right. I mean, it is compensated. And as Teresa was saying, it's very important to get this right. It needs to be an agreement that's in writing. It has to represent the fair market value of the services. Mm-hmm. You want to document the services that are provided. They have to be real and beneficial, and they need to be things that, in fact, help delay the admission into long-term care because you'd need to have somebody else doing this if this person weren't doing it. Mm-hmm. And presumably that would cost the taxpayer. So personal care contracts, while there are some very fastidious, very specific rules that you need to comply with, they're marvelous because, again, this is more likely the person who's not literally at the door of the nursing home. This is somebody who comes in and says, gee, my husband's been diagnosed as having Parkinson's. I think, we see long-term care maybe in the future, but it could be 4 or 5 years or beyond and down the road. It could be some other diagnosis. It could just be that you recognize you're becoming frail. And so that person is ideal for this. They come in and they start a personal care contract with a loved one. And again, you have to dot the I's and cross the T's. It has to be bona fide, legitimate, meet these requirements. But if it does, you could be transferring 1,000 or more a month.
It's a great way to transfer assets to your loved ones without incurring the Medicaid.
Yeah.
Who oversees it? Who's policing this? Is it the Department of Social Services?
No one's policing it. It's a private contract. And remember, you haven't had even, at this stage, you probably haven't even had conversations mm-hmm. with the people at Health Net or the Division of Family Services eligibility specialist. You probably not had even those conversations because you've just simply said, gee, I want to transfer assets to my grandchildren or whoever, and I want them to give me real services. So it has to be real. They got to show up. They got to do these things. Mm-hmm. But the point is, whatever the value is, if the fair market value is $1,000 a week, then that's legitimate.
Could this be a grandchild paying a grandchild to cut your grass, do your gardening,
yes.
whatever. It could be anything like that.
Anything like that where you're getting real value. Now, this was abused for a while, and this went all the way to the Missouri State Supreme Court ruled on this topic. And it was very controversial early on because what people were doing is doing a lump sum contract. They sign a future contract for 10 years, and they give their grandson, they transfer into a trust for their grandkids, if they're smart, not to their grandkids, maybe $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 or some big amount of money. And on this theory that, they've committed on a piece of paper to deliver these services in the future. Well, that's been smacked down. So it can, matter of fact, the rule now, you can only go 2 months. Is that right, Teresa? 2 months either way?
I have to check. But they require the caregiver to log all the different activities and services that they're actually rendering for
yeah.
you.
Yeah,
along
so
with the agreement, yeah.
It does require planning, mm-hmm. and it does require, that you do it properly. But that's an example where if you want to qualify to have your long-term care costs paid down the road and say that you've worked hard all your life, you're not rich, but you have $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, maybe less, maybe $200,000. But it's all everything to you. And you had plans that you wanted your children to enjoy it or your grandchildren, and you just don't want to see it squandered in this way. Those are the people who, with proper planning, if they go, ideally, they'll go see a lawyer before they know that they're going into long-term care. And this is an example of one of those things that can be done. What's another example, Teresa?
For the pre-planning, if we do the long-term planning scenario, ideally, then you can create an irrevocable trust 5 years ahead of time, which means you can come in, you talk to us, and we set up this irrevocable trust and we pair it with a revocable. And anything you put inside that irrevocable trust, technically you're transferring ownership of it. So technically, yes, you're giving it away into this other entity that's the irrevocable trust. But normally people appoint a trustee for that trust. It's somebody that they trust, right?
Mm-hmm. And hence the word
trustee. But so you're giving these assets away, but you're putting it in the care of somebody. And according to the rules, you get to build the rules of this irrevocable trust of how you want those assets to be passed down to your kids or whatnot. So if you do that ahead of time, all these assets that you put in, you wait 5 years, you apply for Medicaid, it's completely shielded from Medicaid's eyes.
And another thing to emphasize there is that some people may say, well, gee, I'm not sure I'm going to make it 5 years. But that's okay. Meaning if you mm-hmm. make it 4 years, it just means that you don't make application until you get through the 5 years.
Right.
So it's beneficial even if you don't quite make it 5 years. Now, if you make it 6 months, granted, that's not much benefit. But this plan is only recommended there's no harm done. Let me hurry to add that. Mm-hmm. If you, in 6 months, you end up needing to apply for long-term care and you can't take refuge in this, there's no harm done. You still have this trust and it's achieved goals that are important to you, et cetera. But for the most part, this is for people who have, you know, a reasonable level of confidence that it's going to be further down the road versus close in.
Hopefully, yes.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple things, though, in fairness, we should mention. Whenever you create an irrevocable trust, you have to give up some level of control. Mm-hmm. Now, you can have all the income. As a matter of fact, these are mm-hmm. often set up as income-only trusts. So it does mean that you'll continue to get any income generated from your assets. But in terms of being able to reach in and spend it when you want, no, that would violate the purpose. The purpose is for this asset to not be considered yours for purposes of qualifying for Medicaid. So there has to be some real sense in which you've placed constraints on yourself being able to reach in and be a beneficiary of that trust. You can have the income, but you can't reach in and spend the principal.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the irrevocable trust, you put, say, $200,000 in there and mm-hmm. you have your trustee. While you're alive, the trustee, are they allowed, say, to take the whole $200,000, or do they have to wait till you've passed on?
Well, you create the terms of your trust, and generally, while you'll identify other beneficiaries, generally you'll have a provision that they're secondary beneficiaries, that until you die, money is not to be distributed to those parties, and that, however, you can only have the income, not the principal. So the principal is generally protected from being paid out to anybody while you're alive. Because you're wanting the income typically to come in.
Okay.
However, you know, you can write the rules as you want. It wouldn't be a Medicaid problem if it could be paid out to third parties. So mm-hmm. that doesn't violate your qualification for Medicaid. It just would reduce your income if the trustee paid it out to a third party. But generally what people do, and you should explain this, Teresa, mm-hmm. how often people want to maybe put some of their assets in an irrevocable trust mm-hmm. and some of their assets maybe in a revocable trust where they can get at it when they want.
Yeah, so ideally, I normally advise against putting everything into an irrevocable, especially if you think you still have 5 years on the road, because that's giving up a lot at one time. So that's why we pair it with a revocable, because with a revocable, think of it as an irrevocable, except you're just not giving up that ownership. So you can still manage all these assets that are in the revocable, do with it what you want. My advice in terms of how to split that up is in the revocable, just have it be an amount that is kind of sustains your standard of living in the meantime, so that if you were to need Medicaid all of a sudden, those assets in the revocable trust can be either spent readily or not given away, but even if given away, it would incur only a small penalty period.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And remember, we can always, as to any assets that are in the revocable trust, there are other tools that we have in our toolbox for a crisis scenario. But the bottom line is that a lot of people are uncomfortable putting all their assets, as Teresa was saying, into an irrevocable trust because they have some rules to live by. Most of us don't like rules, right? But it is the lesser evil than having to give it all away, like the example I gave you a while ago where you spend every nickel of it, mm-hmm. and then finally the Calvary in the form of Medicaid comes in to help you when you're broke. That's not a plan that most people want. So they'll put something in the irrevocable trust. Another popular thing to put in the irrevocable trust is the house.
Yes.
Because that's an easy call.
Yes, you put it into the irrevocable trust because even though Medicaid says that you can keep your house and that they won't count your house in terms of eligibility, that's only shielded from eligibility. At the end of the day, Medicaid will put a lien on your house. So if you don't put it into the irrevocable trust, even if you're getting Medicaid services, at the end of the day, Medicaid's going to want to be paid back for those services rendered to you.
Yeah. And we mentioned last week that, you know, if you have a spouse living in the house, then that can delay it, or a dependent child. But at the end of the day, the state attorney general's office is going to do what's called asset recovery, meaning they're going to want to be repaid for every nickel that Medicaid paid you, and they can take it from your house, either in your estate, or if you've left your house with no intention of returning, no capability of returning, then they can go ahead and take it unless there's that spouse living there.
And there are exceptions, correct? Say you have an adult child that had been taking care of you, and they're the reason you did not have to go into a nursing home, but you still had Medicaid to provide and fund home health care services. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. There are a few of those special provisions. And another is, for example, if you have a sibling who has been a caregiver for you for at least 1 year and also is a co-owner of the house, mm-hmm. then the house can be protected permanently when you leave. But back to the point that Teresa was making a moment ago is the reason people like to put the house in the irrevocable trust is they get to continue living there. So it doesn't change your relationship with your house when mm-hmm. it's in an irrevocable trust versus the way you own it now. Because what do you do with it? You live in it mm-hmm. and you continue living in it. Except when it's in the irrevocable trust, when you hit that 5 years we've been talking about, then that means forever, it's clear. And that house will never be claimed by asset recovery through the Attorney General's office. So that's an easy call. It doesn't affect your lifestyle or your freedom of decisions, et cetera. Even if you sell your house, the trust can sell the house and buy a new one.
Mm-hmm. So While you're alive,
yeah. So those things can still go on. So the house is often a candidate to go into an irrevocable trust. But sometimes, as Teresa was saying, they will include other sums of money. Now, one thing that is worth mentioning is whenever you have tax-deferred assets like IRAs and whatnot, 401ks, those you probably do not want to transfer into the irrevocable trust or even the revocable trust because it is a change of ownership, technically speaking, and it triggers these tax claims.
Yeah.
So most people want to postpone that as long as they can. Although I will say that there are worse things in life than getting hit by the taxes that are on tax deferred assets. And among those worst things is losing your asset entirely, which is exactly what would happen if you make application for Medicaid and you have 401k, guess what? It's not protected. It unlike creditors and other things, you're used to your 401ks getting special treatment or your IRAs. There's no special treatment for IRAs and 401ks when it comes to applying for Medicaid.
What do you do then?
They're liquidated and spent.
And then when you liquidate it, a significant chunk is just lost when you liquidate it.
Yeah, so it's really inefficient. So I have had people who do go ahead and do their planning by transferring the assets into an irrevocable trust. It's not an easy decision. So as a CPA, I can appreciate what people will hear from their accountants. And their accountants, need to run the math. But keep in mind, we're living at a time where the tax rates are lower than it's been in a long time. Someday that taxes will be paid on that money. We know that. It's not as if there's never going to be taxes paid on it. And if you think the tax rate will be significantly higher in the future than it is today, and most people believe that mm-hmm. in 2020, because we do have exceptionally low rates and a whole lot of debt. So if you believe that, then you might decide now when the rate as it applies to you particularly is going to be low because you're probably not working versus if you leave it to your kids who probably are working. So it may make sense to take the hit, especially if you really foresee on the horizon long-term care. Because remember, it's worse than losing, for example, 20% of the value or 25% of the value through taxes is losing 100%. And it's 100% if you're going to end up with long-term care costs. So I'm just challenging that knee-jerk reaction that I never want to do anything to have to pay taxes on my tax-deferred assets. You know, I want to hold them as long as I can. And so there's this common objective now among clients to die with their tax-deferred assets. I guarantee you they didn't start out that way, and they were 21 years old, and you asked them, why are you creating this retirement account? They'd say, well, I'm going to live well when I retire. And now it becomes, I want my kids to live well. Well, you know, but at some point I think that has to be considered when you're thinking about long-term care.
Yes, definitely. If you're just tuning in, we have Teresa Yao joining us, attorney with Tucker Allen. And Teresa, I want to complicate things here, as I like to do sometimes. What happens if the Medicaid recipient owns a business? How can this really complicate the situation, or does it?
So business property is kind of in that gray area in terms of Medicaid exemptions. There are kind of two standards that business property is evaluated against. So if there's direct use in the business, that you're directly using this property in the course of the business, then that property is exempted. A less strict standard for that is if this property, this business is generating an annual return that is proportional to its fair market value. In Missouri, they have found that to be able to exempt the business as well. It really is a case-by-case basis.
But that does make sense, though. I mean, that it's not in the interest of the federal government to have rules that liquidate businesses, which mean employees get unemployed and hardship for the remaining family members, as well as the person who's making application. If this business would otherwise have been generating profits, why do you want them to liquidate it? And maybe you end up at the end of the day with less money available to defer these long-term care costs than if you'd let the business continue functioning. So for the most part, a business that's bona fide, and that's kind of, I guess, another way of saying, Teresa, I guess, these rules. So if the business is bona fide and it's generating a good rate of return, then they're not wanting to count those assets in a way that's going to require you to liquidate the business.
And we're talking more of a small business, a mom-and-pop type establishment.
But, yeah, because if it's a real – if it's a bigger business, you're right, that could be transferred, has a market value, then, yeah, they may very well say, okay, that's an asset. It's like a dividend. So it's like you own stock in AT&T. Is it closer to that example or is it closer to mom-and-pop? So if you imagine two ends of a spectrum – which is this closer to? And if it's closer to mom and pop, then they don't want to disrupt that business. They'll just say, we'll count your income and not the business. But if it's closer to something that can be sold and has a fair market value, they may very well require you to sell a business. But often family businesses, they don't want to disrupt that.
No, I couldn't see that. That's something I think there is this attitude about supporting small business in society.
So what they'll end up doing is have you submit a ton of documents, and this is like the worst audit you've been through at the federal government, and they will have you determine what are the available funds, because they're wanting to show you, if they can prove you have a high enough income, then the subject of long-term care is moot, because you have enough income to pay the costs. So their goal is to prove what the real income is. So it'll be less about the assets and more about the income in that case.
Teresa, you know, some may view that their loved one may not get quality care at a long-term facility if it's being funded through Medicaid. What are your thoughts about that?
The quality of care that Medicaid has, like the reputation that Medicaid has, in terms of subpar care, that really is more of a concern in the past, because honestly, the state and the government, they are very harsh against Medicaid recipients being kind of discriminated against in terms of their care. So there are a lot of programs out there, a lot of regulations out there that restrict the inferior treatment of Medicaid recipients or Medicaid care. An example of that is like the Ombudsman program, where these people check in at nursing homes to monitor the situation to see if they are actually adequately taking care of their Medicaid recipients.
So someone is policing nursing
homes.
Yes,
there are multiple people that are policing the quality of care for Medicaid recipients. So
well, that is really good to know. And with the pandemic, many are concerned about putting their loved one in a long-term care facility. But there are cases where, you know, there's just no other choice. What would you say to a client that maybe had these concerns, these fears?
What I would say is it really depends on the level of care that they need. If it really is 24/7 skilled nursing, then nursing homes really, that's the only place that can really provide an adequate level
of care.
Yeah,
and I'm talking about someone that, say, has advanced Alzheimer's.
There's multiple options. So, yes, number one is receiving care in the nursing home. There's also home and community-based services under both Medicare and Medicaid. The two programs have different standards for administering these home-based services. Medicaid provides these home health services on a more long-term basis, but the eligibility requirements for the home and community-based services under Medicaid are different. This is, again, where I would plug in those caregiver agreements that would be helpful in terms of still providing assets or providing resources to your loved ones without penalizing yourself later when you do need to get into the nursing home at that later point.
And there are so many, you know, we've had so many guests on the show that represented home health care facilities. And there's a lot of choice out there.
Louis area.
Yes, there's a lot of choice out there.
And there's been such a push by Missouri to try to allow people to get the Medicaid payments outside of a long-term care facility because you can do it so much less expensively for the taxpayer. So it's really a win-win to figure out ways to provide the services for home. And unlike Medicare, you don't have to have these qualified specialists who've been certified, et cetera, because the way that Medicaid works is that if these people are providing services and they're even services that are considered custodial as opposed to specialized care, then it still is helping keep somebody out of long-term care because it's often those very custodial activities like cleaning house or preparing meals or helping you get from point A to point B. I mean, all those things.
Going to the grocery store for the individual?
It's those things that are not technically medically specialized that account for people having to make application to go into long-term care in the absence of a program such as this where they can get care at home versus in a facility.
I believe they get what, how many hours a week? Is it 12, 15 hours a week, something like that?
I think it depends on each individual case for how much time, because sometimes it's just like maybe 2 days a week or something that they need the health care, the home health.
Yeah, and the way it works is that the person who's seeking to get these Medicaid benefits at home, then they will make application for Medicaid as they normally would through the Family Services Division, and so they have an eligibility specialist. They will in turn toss the ball over to the Division of Health and Senior Services, and they have a senior services worker who will actually go and make a home visit. And so they're the ones who will certify what's called the need, that this person does need these things.
Assess the situation, sure.
Yeah, and then once they have made their determination, then, of course, you go through the same application process that you would go through financially, but there's a little bit of a different measurement. The measurement does look at the amount of income you have, and so it's important to do the proper planning there. But again, you can do planning on the income side just in that situation, just like you can for the nursing home application.
Yeah, you can still funnel some to the spouse. It's just that your income has to be, there's a certain limit for your income.
Getting back to the spend down, isn't it true that you can take your life insurance policy and transfer it to somebody else?
If it has cash value, it's still going to be an uncompensated transfer. You are allowed to have a certain amount. What is it, $1,500?
Yeah, $1,500. That's like a super low.
Yeah, it doesn't excite me. So I've never had a client jump up and down, oh, $1,500 is exempt on the cash value of my life insurance. But if you can transfer the policy if it has no cash value, and that would not be penalized. But if you have a policy that has $50,000 cash value, in other words, a permanent policy, and you give it to anyone other than your spouse, then it's going to trigger a penalty period.
Or you could do a prepaid funeral.
Yes.
But again, there are limits to that. Although I think that now this is a archaic provision, but I think it's still in effect that you can pay for the funerals of any number of people and they don't have to be related to you. So
what?
Odd as that sounds, you could pay for the funerals of a small town and have all that. None of that would be considered a transfer. But what good is that? Because you've lost your assets, and for what purpose? So there are a few weird provisions like that, but people are looking for opportunities to where they can still pass their assets down to the ones they've loved and spent their lives working for, quite
sure.
frankly, and be able to have long-term care. One thing that I don't think we've talked much about, and that's a qualified annuity. A qualified annuity is worth mentioning because it's really a cool feature where you can take what would be an asset on the balance sheet at the start and then decide, well, gee, this asset is too large because I can only have $5,000, right? So let's assume that you have $100,000 or $150,000. So you can take that, transfer it to your spouse. And remember, a transfer to a spouse doesn't count for purposes of a uncompensated transfer. You can do unlimited amounts of transfers to the spouse. So you transfer to your spouse, and then the spouse buys an annuity. Now, this is a special type of annuity. You can't just run out and buy any annuity. This has to be a Medicaid-qualified annuity, which has certain rules. There are no big lump sum payments. It has to be amortized correctly so that it's actuarially correct based on your age and lifespan. You have to name as a contingent beneficiary after a husband or a spouse you can name first. But after that, you would name for the amount that's owed Medicaid, the Division of Family Services or the state of Missouri. So they'd have to be shown there as a contingent or secondary beneficiary. Once you've done that, what you've done is made an asset disappear off of the books, and now it's become income. So that income, though, the name on that check is to your spouse, not you. So the name on the check is what is important for income, you remember. And then for assets, both assets count. So for husband and wife, it doesn't matter whose name it is. Assets in either of your names are counted for both of you in the original determination of Medicaid eligibility. But when you do this, then you've taken, for example, the $100,000 I mentioned disappears. It's no longer one of your assets. Instead, you have income, but it's not your income. It's the income of your spouse. And remember, income, unlike assets, it's the name on the check. There are techniques such as that you know, we've mentioned a few of them here in this show, but there are a number that we just wouldn't have time to talk about, but are worth consideration in certain circumstances.
Well, you mentioned naming the Missouri Department of Senior Services or Medicaid on there.
Yeah, Missouri Health Net.
Missouri Health Net. So at some point, will they get that?
If there's anything left at your death.
At your death, okay.
Or at the death of the annuitant. If the measuring life is the annuitant, and the annuitant, for example, is the spouse, and they've done their actuarial calculations correctly, then when that spouse dies, there's no value left, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they're like the contingent beneficiary. So the amount that the annuity is paying, that income, it goes to your spouse, and it's like paying it down. And then ideally, the spouse just gets everything from the annuity, and then at that point, then the state doesn't have anything to get.
Have you found that there are some clients that are concerned about putting their loved one into long-term care because of the pandemic? Because we know there has been a drop in long-term care facilities because of this.
Yeah, about 10%, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Personally, I haven't run into that many yet. I think people are still okay going to nursing homes and then kind of because they understand that that level of care is required for the person.
Yeah, we've seen a flow back in. As a matter of fact, Jill, we've had a couple of guests on in the past month who have described how, you know, there's now this reverse flow where people are starting to come back. Now, I don't know with this new outbreak if that'll affect that.
Right, right. And I think there was also the concern because so many facilities weren't allowing the loved ones to visit, you know, in order to prevent the spread of COVID-19, which that would be... My goodness, that would be so difficult not to go visit your ailing mother or father.
It was a big deal, and
And I think that's really as much as anything else that triggered a lot of families coming and getting their loved one and moving them out at points earlier this year. I think, though, that I don't see the industry as being threatened long term. I just think that the demographics are too overwhelming, and there's no efficient alternative to some sort of communal situation. It's just very efficient for the level of care that's needed medically, and have specialists whose attention can be distributed not to one person, but to 10, 15, or 20. The economies of scale are just so great that I think that that model is going to be around a long time.
Right, because I think when people, even if families are taking their loved ones out of nursing homes, I don't think they're anticipating for them to stay in their home forever and after. I think it's just during this pandemic time, making sure that they have each other around.
So after a person's death, does Medicaid have a certain amount of time to file a lien against the person's estate?
Short answer is no. They technically aren't obligated to any time frame for them to bring a claim against an estate. The caveat to that, though, is if an estate is just never open, then technically there's no estate for Medicaid to lay claim on. However, of course, Medicaid can go ahead and try to open up that estate, and they just have to open up that estate within 1 year. And then after the estate is open, they have unlimited period of time for them to lay claim.
So say they wait several years and they go back and they find out that the person's home has already been sold, the assets have been spent. Can they legally go after the beneficiary, say the person's children?
I would say that if Medicaid has been properly notified, first of all, let me tell you that this is a little bit of speculation because I've never known this case happening. I think that if there's proper notification, as there should be, to the state, to the Attorney General's office, when there's death, and remember, part of the probate process is sending out these notices, et cetera, and they sit on their rights, and you have a third-party innocent purchaser, I think they're going to be fine. I think that children who may have known about this lien and didn't do any sort of notification, it either continues on the books, in which case it'll come up when the real estate's transferred, or the person will transfer it and there is nothing on the books, but they had notice, that meaning the child, that side of the transaction, not the innocent third-party purchaser. So in that case, yeah, I think that you could have family members that would have some liability if they weren't sure that there were the proper notifications to the Attorney General's office, who was representing the interests of the state. Now, one thing worth mentioning here is that, you know, there's another occasion when it may come up. Let's assume that when the person dies, it's the surviving spouse is there, and that's not unusual. So they continue living in the house. What for a long time was kind of going under the radar was when the surviving spouse dies, you didn't have the Attorney General showing up to assert claims. But I think the statute clearly permits that.
Right, because that lien is on the property. So after the spouse passes away, in terms of whatever is done with that property, Medicaid is going to be made aware.
Yeah, that transfer, unless they're properly notified, which they could be and they don't do anything, and then the lien would be eradicated through the probate process, meaning that it would be the gavel would go down, title would be held to be in the name of whoever is the beneficiary, maybe a child. And if there was proper notice, then their lien would be eradicated. However, if they don't get notified, then they could show up then. But that's the reason that whenever we're doing this planning, you know, we never fail to at least acknowledge that having something in a homestead is a good fallback position when everything else is exhausted, because there's just enough of a fog around that to where, depending on how lives fall and whatnot, it could be that it never gets tagged. It never gets sold for this lien. Now, again, that's never your go-to bet. I mean, in other words, the probable scenario is that, as we've said already in this show and the last show, is that there is a lien against that house. But sometimes, for reasons we've discussed, it just slips under those. So as a fallback position, when we've done everything else we can think of, you can always spend up to 500 and what? Is it 570,000?
For the home equity?
Yeah,
limit?
For the home equity.
It's 595 right now, I think.
Okay. So 595,000 you can spend in equity on the house. So, I mean, if everything else has been exhausted, all the other remedies, you can take 200,000 cash, dump it in the house. You have a healthy spouse that's going to be there for what you think maybe another 30 years. And it could very well be that you die, then the surviving spouse lives for 20 years, and somehow this lien never, you know, makes its way into cash to the state.
Falls through the cracks, I guess.
Yeah. Now, that's never plan A, just so I'm clear.
No.
But I do want to mention it because it's better than simply writing the checks now to the long-term care facility. So anyway, time has flown. It always does. Teresa, I'm glad you could come back.
Thank you for joining us.
Is with Tucker Allen, and she deals with these issues every day. So this has been another episode of Elder Talk. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Tucker Allen, providing intelligent answers for those thinking about their future with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Tucker Allen. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.